Biological Farming Roundtable podcast helps farmers explore innovative, low-input, regenerative and profitable farming systems. The Biological Farming Roundtable is sponsored by Nutrisoil, an award-winning biological liquid fertiliser made from a big worm farm. Nutrisoil's purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food. My name is Nicola Maddock. I work at Nutrisoil. I envisage a future where farmers are rewarded for producing nutrient-rich foods and consumers have this easily available to them. Today we have a very special interview with Di Haggerty. Di began farming on 660 hectares, which has since grown 20-fold to a 12,000-hectare property in Western Australia's central wheat belt. Di farms with her husband Ian and son James. Di is a well-known speaker on biological farming and an early adopter of this system back in 2008. The recent Charles Massey book, Call of the Reed Warbler, writes, "The Haggertys are two of the most radical and open-minded thinkers in world agriculture. They are not just healing, but also transforming the earth because they are working with and not against Mother Nature." Thanks for being on the show today, Di.
Oh, thanks, Nicola. Thanks for having me.
Could you talk us through how you transitioned your property from a traditional cropping system to a natural biological system?
Yeah, it's a fairly involved story, but we started about 2001. Our first step was to actually put the livestock onto a free choice mineral system, and that was one of the things where we could try and start to balance up some of the soil nutrients through the animal manure as they selected the appropriate ingredients that they needed to maintain their health depending upon the paddocks that they were grazing their feed on. And around the same time, we also attended Arden Anderson and Elaine Ingham presentation in Perth for over about a four-day school. And they really reinforced the whole nutrient integrity side from Arden and the microbial side from Elaine and how integrating those can have a better outcome with your agricultural produce. And I guess the capabilities of your soil and your land to go forward into the future, getting itself better and producing better products as it went. So we started off using some of those practices of biological inputs, I guess you'd call, and dropping out some of the traditional conventional inputs under Arden's recommendations, which was, you know, removing urea and replacing that with sulphate of ammonia and using MAP as opposed to DAP and things like that. And always in the back of our mind was, I guess, some of Elaine's teachings about how the microbial system was so effective in nutrient cycling and disease prevention and so forth and rebuilding resilience in the soil. So we're trying to incorporate that with different compost teas and microbial type things along the same line. Whilst we're also working with the livestock, with Jane Slattery from Adelaide, which was in Victor Harbour at the time, she mentioned to us that if you're going to be utilising anything on your paddock, the best thing would be to get something that had gone through the gut of a worm first, because that's one of nature's ways of getting, I guess, everything in the right order. And so that was where we managed to catch up with Rochelle at Elaine Ingham's course in 2006. And, yeah, that's, I think it was about 2008 that we went full-on liquid inject into our feeding program. And that made a fair bit of difference. We took away all those granulated fertilisers and so forth from that stage and was completely good ever since.
You're right. So you call this a natural intelligence agriculture. How did you get that name?
I think when you sit back and look at it, the whole process is all the intelligence that's involved in what we do is really just the natural systems working. And I think that's the key as we get more and more out of the way as human beings and allow nature to do what it does best. You just can be completely amazed all the time about the intelligence of the system, whether it be the soil seed interactions, the seed microbial interactions, the interactions of the microbes within the guts of the animals and all those things, extremely intelligent, extremely intricate, but once you get out of the way and stop affecting them negatively, they can really become very robust and do things as nature intended.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I heard you say that Jane was a consultant of yours, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so she was the one that recommended the worm liquid to you, and then you also went to Elaine Ingham. What's the big benefits of a worm liquid, do you think, when you're using it in a cropping system?
I think when you look at some of the soils in Western Australia that are known to be some of the oldest, most leached out, probably some of the most fragile soils in the world, to be, you know, utilising them for agricultural purposes, we do need to be replenishing, you know, some of that that's been lost over years and years of erosion and, you know, degradation. And, yeah, Jane said basically that, you know, it makes sense when you look at natural processes that the earthworm is one of those things that nature has in place as a, you know, a promoter of soil health and fertility, as is the composting process and those microbes within the animal's gut. So, yeah, it just became, you know, a bit of a no-brainer for us that if there was something available that we could utilise. And when I met Rochelle, seeing that there was a liquid available that could do that for us, because it's pretty hard to find earthworms out in the wheat belt with the heat and soils there and the low organic matters which are inherent in those areas at this point in time because of, you know, just the degradation that has occurred. Yeah, it's going to take us a long time to rebuild the natural worm populations to the required level. So we thought, well, putting those things out there as best we can, it's going to be putting those signals into that environment again that for the natural microbes, that this was a safe place to be and for them to be able to proliferate and feel a bit more comfortable. Because there's a lot of things that I guess we still don't understand with, you know, both worm digestion and compost processes and all the rest and that which is happening in the gut of the animals that we don't understand, but we don't necessarily need to understand if we can allow them to occur because we're still going to get the benefits even if we don't know what the benefits are that we're truly working with.
Absolutely. So your program has a worm liquid in it. What other things do you use when you're sowing your crops?
It's mainly just the worm liquid and the compost extract are the two main ones. We still are using very low rates of nitrogen, as in about 2 to 4 units per hectare per year, purely because we've been starting from scratch all of the time. In our career, we've worked about 52,000 acres. And of that now, we've only got about 32,000 acres because we've lost leases or whatever in the past. So we've started new farms a lot over the last 15 to 20 years. So we're still having to incorporate a bit of nitrogen within that while we're still building those systems up. So we can see that that'll come to an end at some stage, but we've still got a bit of resilience to be putting back into those soils and getting that nutrient cycling, you know, at full throttle, I guess.
Do you make your own compost extract or do you buy it in?
We do make our own compost extract, but we just buy in the best compost we can possibly source, as the material to use.
Yep. So when you transitioned to using a worm liquid, were you comfortable to speak to your neighbours or your fellow farmers when you're in these early stages of trialling it?
I guess Fran and myself, we're not big social bugs, so we don't go to the pub much. We don't, you know, we tend to mainly work all the time, so there hasn't been a lot of that kind of discussion goes on, because that usually does occur at, you know, your sport or your pub or whatever's happening. But what we did do was travel to different parts of Australia for our annual holiday with the kids, and we talked to different farmers that we found out were doing different things around the place, and we were able to talk quite happily with those because they were people trying different things as well, so they could understand where we were coming from, and we all sort of learnt off each other at the time, which was fantastic.
Yeah. Did you have much anxiety when you changed? Because you started using your traditional fertilisers and you changed to the biological. You know, could you sleep at night? Were you worried? How did you feel?
I think the main thing is if you sit back and look at what you're doing, you know, as conventional farmers, we weren't overly happy with, even though, we're getting good results as conventional farmers and many still do get fantastic results. But the biggest thing we were concerned about was looking at, levels of disease and, you know, why were the plants succumbing to things like rust and insect attacks, things like that. And when you listen to Elaine and Arden and people like that talking, you know, it's pretty easy to join the dots at that point in time. So once you've made a decision, I guess, of what you think the best way for yourself and your own farm and your own family of how you want to go about your farming practice, I think then, yeah, that the anxiety goes out of that because you've made a decision of how you want it to be for you. And it's a matter of just changing the goalposts and knowing what goalposts you're kicking for and just being consistent with that. Not looking over the fence again and saying, oh, well, you know, that's how the conventional system does things and how it performs in this sort of a year. But, you know, I'm aiming for a different goalpost, which might be a medium or long-term aim, but that's where you're wanting to head. So I think make a decision and stick by that.
What really seems to stand you apart from the crowd's eye is that you have a very solid why that's kept you on the same program.
Yeah, we've been very fortunate to mix with some wonderful scientists like Christine Jones, Martin Stapper, Walter Yen in Australia, and some fantastic international ones along the lines of Nicole Masters, Arden Anderson and Elaine Ingham. And it's when you're mixing with people like that that you can really... You know, when you look at their experience and what they've seen and understand, it makes it a really simple process to understand that you've got to keep working in that same direction because that's the where the demand will be in the future, and particularly with consumers becoming increasingly aware of the quality of the food they're feeding their families and the health benefits associated with that. It's a bit of a no-brainer because as farmers we are food producers firstly, and we've got to keep that in the forefront of our minds.
What about the banks? Were they supportive of your alternative farming methods when it appeared in your budget?
Well, I think the banks have been fantastic. We've been very lucky. I don't know whether it's across the board, but we've had excellent bank managers, and I think it's been just a case of getting them out on the header and they see with their own eyes. And the banks are probably across it more than some of the ag areas and ag services, really, because they're focusing quite a bit, and it seems some of the big four banks and some of the other banks on that natural capital process and understanding, you know, the, I guess, the risk management with agriculture and climate change or whatever else that might be out there that everyone's having to deal with. Yeah, the banks are certainly not sitting on their hands in that space, and we do find they've been really good, but it's been, has been a case of, you know, just clear communication. And having them out there on the headers and seeing with their own eyes so they know what's going on and they see the results.
Yep. Oh, that's fantastic. How did your first crop grow? When you first changed your system, it must have been pretty exciting to watch. Was it successful?
Oh, it's been a gradual process, I guess. McFarlane, yeah. As I said, when we first started, we were just sort of taking small steps and, you know, feeling our way, and then... Yeah, so I guess it was from about 2001 to 2008, really, that we were sort of fiddling around doing bits and pieces, but the most consistent factor at that stage was the livestock, which has been consistent throughout. So that's been a good thing. But, yeah, as I said, it was about 2008 where we made the complete change to liquid.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so it has been a bit of an evolution. But, yeah, they've just sort of gone on, you know, well, and we've seen... I guess that reduction in disease and all those incidences very quickly, so you can be happy to see that, you know, that immune system function of the plant and the animals has been responding quickly. And I guess that's part of it with the animals as well. And I think when you read Charlie Massey's book, The Call of the Reed Warbler, how Charlie talks about the whole epigenetic side of things, and that's something that has really caught our attention because the livestock being the consistent factor all the way along has demonstrated those things and that you can't necessarily see under the ground as well, whereas you can see it quite clearly in the animals and the plants, how they've responded. What's happening under the ground is still a whole other world that we don't know enough about, but we can just see the outcomes in what's above the ground, I guess.
Yeah. So the epigenetics is about self-replacing stock and seed, is that right?
That's part of it. That's where you can capture the most progress, I guess, because at the end of the day, it's when is during that gestation period that things are being passed on to the newborn and having seed that's evolved. So it's just that co-evolvement of animals or plants with their environment. So, yeah, as the environment's enhanced, so can the animals and the plant genetic expression be enhanced. So, it is really working at the whole package together and getting synergies as a result of that. And that's been just an amazing thing to be able to observe.
Yeah. You and Ian speak to lots of farmers who have moved to this system or something similar. What's the most common reason for people failing or giving up?
I think perhaps maybe they might not have made the decision hard enough in the first place and still looking over their shoulder a bit.
Yeah,
that does seem to be the thing. And sometimes it's been two changes of generation where the older generation might have, you know, looked back on their farming career and thought, gee, we need to make some changes here. And then sometimes the younger guys coming through, you know, perhaps having more influence with the mates at the pub, and that sometimes think, well, okay, well, I want to try some of this other way of doing things, because the technology is a very exciting area in agriculture. There's been a huge amount of progress along those lines, and that's a pretty attractive, you know, way of going about things. So I think it really just depends on the decision you make as a farming family of how you want to go about things and how you're able to engage all parts of the family or whatever business to make that decision together. You can't see each other sometimes. That's just from what we've experienced with other people talking to us. It just seems to be one of the issues if that decision's been made as a whole business together.
Yeah, it's the mindset. It's what Charles Matthew talks about in his book, isn't it? It's if we can change people's mindsets, then you can stay in the correct direction.
That's right, because then you're all supporting each other and working together in the same direction. So I think that's really important that you all have to have the, you know, similar understanding and you're working together as a team.
Yeah, absolutely. The traditional soil test method, do you monitor your crop's performance or your, you know, what you need for your next crop through soil tests, or do you use tissue tests? What's your main form of assessment?
We don't use a lot of soil tests, but we do some occasionally to, you know, look at things that we've been very fortunate and had some deep soil carbon testing done, which was absolutely fantastic, gave us some wonderful information. But as an agricultural tool for our cropping, we don't use a lot of it, mainly because we find that it can be very variable and, you know, just a snapshot in time, I guess, of where that soil is at that point in time, and can change quite rapidly depending upon whatever conditions unfold. So we tend to rely more on using tissue tests with the crop, because it does then tell us exactly what the plant is able to access and utilise and in its growth period. And then if it's lacking anything or whatever, or out of balance or whatever, you can find that out pretty quickly. Whereas with soil tests, whilst the soil may have been rich in certain components, it wasn't always transferred into the tissue test results. So, and that was what one of the early things that made us think very much about that microbial interface, because it's, you know, seemed to us that it was the microbial interface that was lacking. If there was nutrients in the soil that weren't getting into the plant, there was obviously other ways for other things at work that we weren't able to capture in those times. So we wanted to make sure that we could utilise what was in the soil, or even what might not necessarily be showing on a soil test in very good quantities. You could still find within the tissue test that the plant was able to access it from somewhere. So whether it was way deeper or whatever, using the mycorrhizal fungi system or whatever, I can't explain exactly how it happens, but we've seen, you know, plant tissue tests that are defying the soil test. So we find that a preferred method at this point in time.
Yeah. And with your tissue test, are you finding any deficiencies that you need to add or...?
Down at the Darren properties, it was quite often that there would be boron deficiencies down there, so we would put boron in as part of the foliar program.
Yeah.
That's probably been the main one, and there's probably a couple of properties that have had a deficiency in molybdenum on some of the red country. So, when those things come up, then you can just deal with that in your foliar program.
Okay. lime and gypsum, I mean, you've got sandy soil, so you wouldn't be needing to add a lot. Do you use those additives at all?
It's in Western Australia, it's very common now to be using a couple of tonnes of lime to the hectare fairly regularly. We haven't done liming programs and found that the rooting depth of the plant has been more than sufficient. We're finding that using the microbial system and coating the seed and having, adequate rhizosheath development, that we're getting excellent root penetration down. So even if there is acid soil, we farm some seriously acid soils, some of them 4 to 4.5 pH in the subsoil of about 15 centimetres down. And normally that should, burn off the roots or J-curves or whatever, but we're able to penetrate through them. So really lime isn't that terribly necessary. And the calcium levels, if you're looking at lime for calcium, are mostly pretty good too. So there wasn't, a problem there. We could deal with that in a foliar manner as well. But, calcium seemed to be coming, those levels seem to be coming up better than they used to be anyway without necessarily applying those things.
Yeah. I know that Martin Stafford talks a lot about when you've got a healthy biological system around that rhizosphere, you can have quite a neutral pH in very acid soils.
Yes.
Yeah. I've been told that you don't have any chemically resistant weeds. Is that right? Do you have no chemically resistant weeds?
I don't know if you could say that, in that a lot of the farmers we take on have been fairly seriously degraded, and we've done a few different tests at times on chemical resistance, and some of the Gowran properties did have a few issues there, but it comes down to management at the end of the day, whether it presents as a problem. And what we're finding is that over time those weeds become more and more susceptible to the chemical you use, and you're able to reduce rates and reduce frequency. So I don't think that chemical resistance is something that we need to be concerned about. And certainly we've had a few jokes lately with, there's a lot of focus on radish weeds in Western Australia. It's become one of the most prevalent ones and quite resistant to chemicals. And we still vow and declare that we've got the best radish destructors out there in the four-legged sheep that not only, convert the radish to good nutrients in the manure, but they clean up a lot of the other stuff as well. So, I think it's all.
Yep. And cover crops, we're constantly trying to sow these radishes in.
Cover crops are a great intermediary tool in trying to get things happening. For us, in our environment, we like to allow nature to make some of those decisions too. At the end of the day, nature's sort of got a good armament of seeds that are available in the soil, and just different ones start to germinate and appear as the soil conditions change, as it becomes, a bit along that epigenetic line that Charlie talked about. Well, it's the same sort of thing with plant progression and emergence and so forth, and what things tend to flourish over time as those conditions change. So, I think you do need to be a little bit careful that you're not trying to dictate everything, that you do allow nature the space to make those appropriate choices.
You're well known for your summer weed covers. That's something that a lot of people are very uncomfortable about, so they're sowing particular summer multi-species cover crops, where you and Ian are very comfortable to let nature's choices cover your ground over summer.
Well, one thing is by miles the cheapest alternative. Two, those plants tend to survive better. And three, once again, as you see the succession, it comes away from what you would actually term as a weed to the more palatable grasses. And we see that the things like the melons and the caltrop and those plants that are problem weeds, which we do have to deal with too on our farm, as they arrive, we can't have them because they affect your feeding process. But they quickly diminish in number, and you start to see more of the natural grasses come back, and the summer active grasses, and some of them being perennial. And yeah, I think that's just a wonderful way to go, because then they come up at any stage, if it's rained, whether you've had the repeater out or not, those ones will start to come back without you having to do anything. And that's a far cost-effective way of doing things in our environment, which is low rainfall and low input, if you're going to try and, you know, remove that risk.
Yeah, so you troublesome weeds, you do use a selective herbicide, but over time they become less of an issue, is this what you're saying?
That's right. They can rapidly deplete in number and become far less of an issue. So, the other plants, the preferred plants, tend to outcompete them and change that environment so those ones don't germinate.
Yeah, yep. Do you have any trouble with seed set into the cash crop?
Not from the summer plants as such, no. It's only really, you know, from the winter annual plants that are going to complete with your winter crop. Things like ryegrass, and that we're trying to actually encourage that because it is a good feed source and it's an excellent soil conditioner.
Right.
Whereas some people would try and, you know, kill all the ryegrass, for us it is a valuable tool. And it also does appear to be quite susceptible to any pre-emergent herbicides. If you've got the soil in a better state of repair, the weeds are more susceptible. There's no doubt about that.
So nitrogen tie-up is a big problem with stubble retention in no-till systems. Is it an issue in your type of system?
Not particularly when you're using the livestock to graze the stubbles over the summer period. And I guess it's just a case of matching the numbers of livestock and the paddock sizes and so forth so that you can have adequate animal impact to break that down and trample some of it. Yes, it certainly seems to be if you've got appropriate livestock that can utilise the stubble by having the right microbes in the gut so that they can capitalise on the nutrients from that.
Absolutely, adding the nitrogen in.
It will, yep.
Yeah, okay. It's quite astounding to farmers that your production can match conventional yields. However, your system can start making a profit from as low as 0.75 tonne due to your low input costs. Why do you think that more people aren't transitioning to this type of system?
Oh, I guess it's just mindset, I guess, isn't it? It has been very much a focus on yields has been a key driver, and that's probably been set up by our whole system of selling the produce. It's been about numbers or kilograms and tons, as opposed to what is the important part of that. Is it, you know, the nutrient component, as opposed to just having tons and tons of stuff? And that's how our whole system has been geared towards. That you get paid more for yield as opposed to the actual intrinsic quality of that food stuff or fibre that you're producing. And that's where it's sort of come a bit unstuck. So to produce more, there's been more requirements of having, you know, everything covered, whether it be any site disease risk or weed burden or whatever else has had to be taken out of the equation to ensure that the crop has absolute best chance of maximum yield for every season, but then that comes along with an increased financial risk as well because of the higher input. So we've probably taken a step back and changed our goalposts to be wanting to produce an optimum yield for a season with the best nutritional and microbial outcomes for that food stuff, so that whatever we produce for the endpoint consumer has the best nutrient balance we can provide, but also the most appropriate microbial interface. And there's been a lot of research now into gut microbiomes and how that's directly linked to our human health, and I think we're probably providing the foodstuffs that can support that.
Absolutely. If farmers or wholesalers are interested in being part of this system, you have a company called Biointegrity Growers that can facilitate this if they're on a large scale. Do you want to tell us a bit about this?
The company's in its very early stages. It was originally designed to enable us to get volume of produce, I guess, so that as we access food markets, other farmers can be able to provide, you know, if they were utilising similar processes of food production, that they could then have access to selling that on to consumers, and then consumers could be assured of what foodstuff they were accessing. So it's really just trying to be that intermediary of bringing people together and providing that food marketing opportunity.
Mm, yeah, and people can just Google biointegrity growers if they want to read up about that.
That's right, yes.
Is there any other issues that you see need to be addressed to support the future of farming?
I think at the moment, Nicola, some of the, there's two points that I think of there. Firstly, is just providing the opportunity for consumers to have a choice of selecting foods that are going to promote their own good health, but conserve and promote the health of the environment that we all live in. And the second one is then having the people out in the regional areas growing the food. At the moment, a lot of the areas in Western Australia in particular, and probably throughout a large part of the globe, there's a lot of people moving away from the regional areas into the cities and not having the people out there to be growing the food. We need to have a revitalisation of those rural and regional communities so people living out there and working out there and growing high-quality food stuff can have the family environment, the social environment, education for their children, etc., so that they can have an enriched life themselves, and just to really attract people out into those areas and rebuild those communities.
Thank you for your time today, Di. It's so encouraging to know that there's a proven system in agriculture that's profitable for farmers and will make huge inroads into addressing human and climate health.
Oh, thanks very much, Nicola, and thank you very much for the opportunity. Cheers.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, bye.
Please follow the Biological Farming Roundtable podcast. Share it with your friends and networks. I'm Nicola Maddick and I work at Nutrisoil, a liquid biological fertiliser made from a big worm farm whose purpose is to empower farmers to produce life-enriching food.